Welcome to the party, pals. It's time for another explosive episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. Dot making it all the way to the seventh layer of the safe.
Dot making it awkward.
Yes, that is... I think it took longer for you to get to the dot com than it takes to get to the end of this movie.
Dot com.
You're on fire. You're on fire
dot
so
com.
Far.
Dot com.
This is, of course, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast. So good, it just has to be fattening. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist. He's a screenwriter. He's a lieutenant of Megaforce. He's the guy I definitely didn't bring along just for his charming personality, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's going.
This is an auspicious day for so many reasons.
We're going to die hard, man.
Oh, boy.
It's a movie I love so much, I've actually Swede-ed it. Have you seen the Swede that we made at Convergence, sweetheart?
No, I was there that year. That was a thing to behold for sure. But by the way, speaking of things to behold, you can find our entire back catalog on Blog Talk Radio as well as on iTunes. If you go to iTunes, please leave us a 5-star review and leave our 5-star rating and leave a review. I always like to read those. Very much appreciate it. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook. Wow, I'm getting tongue-tied, and we're 3 minutes into this episode. Way to go, Brian. You can like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/... Junk Food Cinema.
I love how you're like, in order to get over being tongue-tied, you're talking to a child like they have a learning disability.
I'm talking to myself in my headphones as if I have a learning disability. And you know what? Not far off. And if you really like the show, if it's the kind of thing that you would steal all of the money from Nakatomi for, well, if you're going to pull off a heist anyway and steal negotiable bearer bonds from a major corporation, maybe slide a little bit of that extra change our way in the form of Patreon. Patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. Is a great way for you to financially support the show, and for as little as a dollar an episode, you actually get access to content that no one gets to hear, and at the $5 level and above, you get access to an entire extra episode every month called The Deep Dish.
The Deep Dish.
The deepest of Chicago-style extra episodes just for you, and we really do appreciate it. We are, in fact, only, I think, $5 away from hitting our $700 goal, which is insane and awesome, and I don't even know what to say, you guys. I've bowled over by your generosity. And I want to take the time to thank a couple of people, our editor/producer Merrill Barr, and coming this now, we actually have a research team. I want to thank Kevin, Mike, and Riley for coming together as our junk food think tank, our kitchen crew, if you will. I am super excited to have you guys on board, and really excited that we are officially kicking off Summer of 88, bitches!
So, you knew it was coming.
How could you not? How could we not?
Welcome to the party, pal!
I believe in you.
You pissed off a mafioso killer just to be loved by a bunch of fucking strangers.
It is accomplished!
You bet! Sugar Ray, he bad in there. Who that? You, the new boy here. Mike, look like a bulldog. He bad at him, too.
Do you really think you have a chance against us, Mr. Cowboy?
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
You know, I remember last year debating whether we should even think about it because the list was a little thin, comparatively speaking. Like when I pitched Summer of 86 2 years ago, it's like, dude, there are so many movies you haven't seen that you need to watch. And like at that point, you had not seen Project X or The Wraith or, you know, a lot of that crazy stuff we found that summer. I wanted a chance to revisit it and got to revisit and rediscover some old favorites. And then Summer of 87, when we looked at the list, it was a no fucking brainer. It's like, Jesus Christ. It was a summer so big, we literally did it for like half the year.
Yeah.
Like we literally have our 2017 Junk Food Cinema was Summer of 87. And then we get to Summer of 88, and it's like, maybe.
Yeah.
And so what we decided to do.
Oh, this is exciting.
We're doing two summer bits. we are actually going to do the best of Summer of 88 because 88 has some really great gems in it. Some really oddball stuff that you've forgotten is cool and some epic stuff like today. We're talking fucking Die Hard. And then we're going to go and do Summer of 78 in the second half of the summer.
We're going to flip the script midway through.
Because it's one of those things where you look at Summer of 78 and you're like, how good can that be? And it's like, oh, Jesus Christ, that summer is literally epic. There are at least half a dozen classic films that came out of that summer. It's rare to get three classic films out of a single summer. When you get a summer that you can get half a dozen classics, that you can get about 8 or 10 episodes worth of, holy shit, you need to watch these movies, or you already know these movies by heart. It was like, yeah, we've got to do that. So that's what we're doing. We're going to do Summer of 88, and then we're going to move into Summer of 78. And oh my God, guys, it's going to be a fun fucking summer.
Yeah, I'm super excited about this concept. So yes, we will be doing Summer of 88 for half the summer, and then we're going to put our thing down, flip it in, reverse it, and do Summer of 78.
We're
going
to smack it up, flip it, rub it down. Oh no.
I think the oh no was the most accurate part of that, for sure.
And then we're not doing Summer of 89.
No.
I assure you.
No, that's not happening.
Anybody who has listened to the show long enough has probably heard me say that. There will be no Summer of 89. I assure you, we will find something else to do. What we might do next year, we might just do Summer of 99.
Yeah, we're
like, Summer of 99's got some cool fucking shit in it.
Yeah, no, we're considering a few different things, but definitely kicking things off with Summer of 88 with quite possibly not only the biggest movie of Summer of 88, but the most, I would argue, the most important movie of 1988, and that is, of course, John McTiernan's Die Hard!
Die Hard!
It's Christmas Eve in L.A.
California.
Is Daddy coming home soon?
We'll see what Santa and Mommy can do, okay?
A New York cop, John McClane, has come to see his wife.
I missed you.
Instead, he's going to have to save her.
Sit down.
Within this skyscraper high above the city, 12 terrorists have declared war.
They're about to be taught a lesson in the real use of power.
They're as brilliant.
Because I am interested in the $640 million in your vault.
As they are ruthless.
But I'm telling you, you're just going to have to kill me.
Okay.
We do it the hard way.
Now, the last thing McClane wants.
Think, damn it, think.
Is to be a hero.
Where's Holly?
Hey, Tucker!
Where?
But he doesn't have a choice.
What does he think he's doing?
Job.
How you feeling?
All things being equal, I'd rather be in Philadelphia.
Only John can drive somebody that crazy.
He's an easy guy to like.
Come out to the coast, we'll get together, have a few laughs.
And a hard man to kill. Bruce Willis, Die Hard.
Got invited to the Christmas party by mistake. Who knew?
A cultural touchstone doesn't even begin to describe what Die Hard became.
It's a movie about John McClane and Die Hard.
Die Hard!
Die Hard!
Wait, what are we doing?
We're singing the song by Jerry Messerschmidt called Die Hard.
Oh, I didn't know. I didn't know that was a real thing. I thought we were just riffing.
It's a real thing that Jerry Messerschmidt wrote.
Okay.
It's pretty fucking great.
I thought it was for the Lonely Groobers, our Die Hard cover band.
That is correct.
And right now, what's great about doing a movie like this to kick off Summer of 88 is that I don't have to sit here and tell you what it's about. I don't have to run through the plot because 99% of you listening to this have seen Die Hard.
Yeah, like a billion times.
A billion times. But what's great about Die Hard is every time you rewatch it, and this recording will serve as testament to this, you will discover something new, you will discover something interesting that you didn't see before, and the story behind this movie is fucking crazy.
It's bonkers. It's totally bonkers. This movie, this is one of those great classic Hollywood stories like Casablanca that did not end up anything like what they wanted, and instead they got something so much better than they had ever hoped for. They created something that redefined the landscape. In fact, let me talk about something. This is something I talked about heavily last year, and I talked about during summer of 86. We have crossed the line, junkies. We are in 88 right now. Audiences have flipped. They are no longer seeking out genre. They are no longer, there is science fiction, fantasy. The era of the fun 80s movie is dead. It is just dead. Everything audiences want is much more realistic and much darker. And as we're going to get into the summer, we've got some good genre fare, but it's stuff where nobody's quite sure what's working and what isn't. And even the genre is trying to root itself in reality. A movie we're talking about next week is a horror movie, but it's a Catholic horror movie. And it's a movie that's trying to root itself in actual belief, in actual beliefs of people in the world and create a horror movie that way, as opposed to what you will find, you know, what you found 2 years ago, where you've got wacky shit like a guy dying in a car accident and coming back to get revenge as a road racer. Like, that era is gone. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the highest grossing movies of 1988, even the genre fare is like this. And this is why I went on that ramble, is because what's important to note about Die Hard is it is this movie in this era that is gritty, raw, and our hero gets the shit kicked out of him.
Yes.
And not, you don't, the, they actually had a continuity person who tracked how dirty the wife beater is,
yeah,
through this movie, because he gets more and more fucked up through the course of this film. And that was amazing. And that was something we hadn't seen. This wasn't a guy going through a hail of bullets without, you know, getting
completely unscathed.
Instead, this is a guy who's so cut and beat to shit by the end of the movie that his wife audibly fucking gasps the first time she sees him, because he's fucked up.
You didn't see a lot of action heroes in this time picking glass out of their bare feet as a scene in a movie. Like, the amount of pain and torture that John McClane is put through in a situation that he did not create, he did not plan. This is my first and most favorite thing about Die Hard, is that it borrows from the Hitchcock tradition of the wrong man in the wrong place at the wrong time, and just takes that and beats the shit out of that wrong man and really puts him through the ringer to test his mettle. And it's absolutely my favorite thing about this movie. It has nothing to do with the villains. It has nothing to do with the explosions. It's the fact that our hero is, yes, he's a cop, so he has a certain amount of training, but not for fucking this. This is, he's on vacation and this shit goes down. He is in way over his head, and sometimes he makes the wrong decisions. He's not flawless, but he's dealing with it the best way he can, and that's really why we are so invested in him.
And for several movies, that carries on.
Yes.
Until he starts to become an indestructible superhero, at which point we stop caring, because it's that vulnerability.
Yeah.
And it's that strength through adversity that makes John McClane so fascinating of a person, because as a person, he's kind of a shit.
Yeah.
Like, he's kind of a shit to pretty much everyone in this movie. Like, he makes a bad first impression on just about everybody.
Yeah.
But he's John McClane, so that charisma carries through. But he's a bit rude to Argyle up front. You know, he's insulting him in the music on the way over. He, you know, when he meets Ellis, you know.
Do you have any Christmas music? This is Christmas music. Christmas in Hollis. Oh, my God, I love it.
It's Christmas time in Hollis, Queens. But, yeah, he's, like, he's a bit, like, he's a bit abrasive to Mr. Takagi. Like, he's.
Yeah. I didn't know they celebrated Christmas in Japan.
Yeah. Yeah, he's...
By the way, can we talk... Just a quick sidebar here.
Hold on. Oh, let's make the drinks at the sidebar.
Oh, of course. I'm going to make myself a little Christmas martini here.
Sidebar!
What the fuck is with his act? Bruce Willis has never been more New York in his fucking life than he is in this movie. Like, that accent is, like... When you do an impression of Bruce Willis in this movie, it sounds like you're just doing, like, bad first-year theater. Like, I got cast in I got cast in a role in a New York, like, one act, and this is my accent now.
This was his big break, and he went from being a comedy TV star to trying to be a movie star.
Right.
And was trying to act his ass off, and he would subsequently find out that he's one of those people that we don't want to see him act. Like, he would try to act, but no...
Currently, I agree with that statement.
But that's, I mean... Let's current, you know, slate of films and personality aside, there are just certain movie stars that we plop down our $15 to see that. I don't want to see Dwayne Johnson immersed in a character where he's unrecognizable. I'm paying $15 to see the fucking Rock.
That's a good point.
You know, I want to see that, you know, that this person be this person, and what I like about this person, it's both the blessing and the curse of Will Smith, where Will Smith was so fucking likable when he played an unlikable character in a movie. The movie failed and they had to reshoot the third act, and that was Hancock was totally reworked because the audience would not accept that Will Smith would do awful things, and they hated the movie because the movie made Will Smith awful. You know, Ben Affleck's that way as well. Like, there, you have these actors. Where on the other hand, Matt Damon is the opposite. We love watching Matt Damon act, but you know, you're not necessarily paying to see Matt Damon be Matt Damon. But with Ben Affleck, that's, you know, that's one of the things that really worked for him. And Bruce Willis is one of those guys. We want to see Bruce Willis be Bruce fucking Willis, but he didn't quite know that yet. And so he was acting his ass off and doing a great job. But yeah, the accent seems weird coming out of him when you know 50 other films by him.
Right.
But I still, every time I watch this movie, like, that's fucking John McClane. Like, that's, you know, it's not later John McClane, because later John McClane just doesn't give a shit.
Later John McClane cannot be bothered.
But early John McClane, I mean, that accent is pretty consistent through the first three movies.
This is true. This is true. I guess I'm just thinking about the Bruce Willis that we now know, and how it's a lot like when you watch the first Mad Max and Mel Gibson's Australian accent is out of control. And then you slowly watch that accent disappear forever. The more Mel Gibson movies you watch.
Yeah.
And it's baffling. But let's talk for just a minute about all of the people involved. We'll get to the cast, obviously, but this is a murderer's row of people we have talked about in a lot of other junk food cinema movies. I mean, starting right off the top with John McTiernan, we've done episodes on Nomads, Predator, Basic. Like, this is a director.
I don't know that there's any. Is there any good John McTiernan left that we haven't already covered? We may.
Hunt for Red October.
Shit. Okay. Yeah. I was going to say, is this the last McTiernan film we'll cover? No.
I think at some point we're going to have to do Die Hard with a Vengeance, because I think that movie has a very strange, like, fans have a very strange relationship with that movie.
Well, didn't we post the live show that we did where we talked about Die Hard with a Vengeance?
Which live show?
The live show we did up in Omaha last summer.
Oh, no, we didn't. I mean, we were really just kind of spitballing between movies. We haven't done an actual full episode on Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Okay, well, that I had already considered that we had done that, but because we haven't talked about that publicly.
Last Action Hero is a movie we're definitely doing. So all of the movies we still have left. Nope, it's already on the card. Can't help you. sorry to say. But no, I you know what? I tried to watch The 13th Warrior the other day. And
didn't. I liked 13th Warrior when it came out.
Yeah. Have you revisited it? Or
I haven't.
You should.
But you know what that movie is, right?
Yeah, no, and it's an interesting story, but it just it's so cut to shit. It's so, because of what happened, like it's edited so like on a fucking sewing machine that it's really hard to get into. So I was not a fan. But you know,
yeah. For those of you that don't know what we're talking about, 13th Warrior was McTiernan's film that was an adaptation of the John. God, wrote fucking Jurassic Park.
Michael Crichton,
yeah. Book Eaters of the Dead, and which was a modern, which was a realistic retelling of
Beowulf.
Of Beowulf, mm-hmm. And it's really a fascinating take. And I like what McTiernan did with the movie 20 years ago when I saw it. But I have not revisited
it. Yeah,
so.
It'll be interesting. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts. But again, we've got McTiernan. We've got Stephen E. D'Souza as the writer on this.
Well, we've got McTiernan in his fucking prime.
Yes.
He did Nomads, which got him Predator, which got him this. This is
absolutely
his third fucking movie. He has gone Nomads, Predator, Die Hard.
Yeah.
Before he would then go into Hunt for October. This guy is in the middle of one of the greatest directing runs in history.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. From Nomads to Hunt for Red October, from 86 to 90, just hit, like bam, bam. Maybe not like hit commercially with Nomads, but
no, but Nomads was a critical success in that it got him all that attention that then got him Predator one summer, then following up the next summer with fucking Die Hard.
Yeah.
Then following that up with Hunt for October. Like, talk about your quotable blockbuster movies and all of them standing the test of time.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, as I mentioned, writer Stephen E. D'Souza, who has, you want to talk about a controversial figure in the area of what we do, because he has been, his name is on some legendary movies like Die Hard. He is also, however, the director of such films as Street Fighter, and he has written movies like Judge Dredd. He has written movies like Beverly Hills Cop 3 and Knock Off, and, you know, again, Hudson Hawk, movies that guys like us, yeah, we'll talk about, we'll enjoy, but not exactly the same, you know, the same batting average as John McTiernan's first four movies.
No, but although, small little plug, if I remember correctly, there is a pretty great interview with him on 80s All Over.
I would all day listen to that. The stories that guy must have to be incredible.
Yeah,
I mean,
he's one of those screenwriters that's been in the trenches. Like, in terms of screenwriters, he is from a particular era and was right there with everyone else and did enough great stuff that you look the other way. Like, we don't talk about Street Fighter. Like, there is no Street Fighter in this dojo.
I kind of want to, though.
I know you do. Yeah. You know what? I'll let you talk about Street Fighter if I can talk about Street Fighter 2 Legend of Chun-Li.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Your proposal might be acceptable. He's written movies that we've covered, Running Man, Ricochet. He's a writer on movies like fucking 48 Hours. So, again, his name is on some legendary stuff. His name is also on some things that are only legendary to guys like Cargill and I. So it's very up in the air. But then, of course, the music in this movie, the jingle bell laden, ominous action score of Michael Kamen.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Michael Kamen fucking took the fourth movement of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony.
Yeah.
And fucking turned it into three different fucking songs through the course of this thing. There's an amazing moment.
Ode to Efficiency.
Yeah. He's just, the way he's playing around with the themes from Ode to Joy and using them both as ominous music and celebratory music for the bad guys.
Yes.
Like, it's so brilliantly done. It's just masterful. And then, yeah, the way they play around with the various, you know, the way he plays around with Christmas music and everything in this film, Kamen just is firing on all cylinders here.
And he might be the person of everyone involved with this movie that is a junk food cinema legend. He might be the one who has the most previous credits as far as movies we've covered, because he did the score. He worked with Queen on Highlander. He did the score for Lethal Weapon, for Roadhouse, The Last Boy Scout, Three Musketeers, Event Horizon, which I believe are all movies we've covered.
Event Horizon!
Event Horizon! God, that's a thing that I'm so happy exists. I can't even tell you how happy I am.
If only Kamen had written it.
Yeah, right. And then cinematographer Jan DeBont. I mean, Jan fucking DeBont, who became so important to the action movies of the 90s, is the cinematographer on this movie.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing, is that's what got him the gig, was he was such a great cinematographer that he wanted to move into directing. And really, I've always felt that was a mistake. Like, I hate to say that. Because DeBont has directed a couple of good films.
Speed and Twister.
Yeah.
Literally, a couple of good films.
and even then, I the problem with both of those movies, they're both heavily flawed in terms of structure. But the thing is they're so beautiful and they're so well done and they're so well paced in terms of what it does. I feel like at least he was working, he was getting it. But I feel that Jan DeBont would be one of the great, you know, half dozen cinematographers today, still fucking chunking out amazing stuff, if all he focused on was capturing the image.
Right.
Because stuff that he's done in the past, even his early work, is fucking ridiculous. Like his work on, he was the one on Night Warning, right? That was fired after a week. He shot the opening car crash and he got fired because he was too slow.
Night Warning. Why am I blanking on what's Night Warning?
Oh, a truly mad early 80s psycho flick with the where one of the actresses famously went crazy on set.
Butcher Baker Nightmare Maker. That's the alternate title. It's local Austin actress. Yeah, Susan Tyrell. Susan Tyrell. Yeah, now
I know it as Night Warning.
I know it as Butcher Baker Nightmare Maker.
We're talking about the Bo Svenson movie for those of you who are
right.
And it's like literally the actress in that movie lost her shit during a scene where her character is smashing this girl's head into a rock, and the actress literally started doing it and started smashing another actress's head into a rock, and it is an infamous story. The movie is batshit as fuck. It's
highly recommended. Highly recommended.
This movie's so fucked up. But I'm pretty certain it was Jan de Bont who was the cinematographer for that opening car crash that triggers everything.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Which is gorgeous and gory and fucked up, and it's pure de Bont. And then, of course, he was fired because he was too expensive because they were making a no-budget movie.
Right.
He would then go on to become, you know, one of the greatest cinematographers of the 80s, and then move on to being a director whose movies look very pretty.
Yeah.
And I want to live in an alternate universe where Quentin hires Jan de Bont to film one of his movies. Like, that, I want to see what that looks like.
Yeah. And I think that actually is everyone we need to talk about. I don't think anyone else involved with this movie has ever been discussed on the show before. So
yeah,
I don't,
definitely no producers.
No,
that you would do an impression of.
No, I mean I'm beyond. I mean I can't
just do the fucking impression.
How dare you not fucking mention me? How dare you? I will fucking buy and sell you 14 times. You cannot talk about Die Hard without talking about Joel motherfucking Silver. What is wrong with you?
You really can't. In fact, I think I told the best Die Hard story I know about Joel Silver. Already, but I'm going to tell it again.
Why not? Well, go for it.
The story, as I've heard it, is that...
By the way, allegedly...
Allegedly.
Giant flag under which we are telling the story.
Allegedly, he was dating this woman and had told her, hey, you know, you date me, I'm going to get you a role in my next movie. And so he dated this super hot blonde and put her in his next movie, and his next movie was Die Hard. And you can see Joel Silver's ex-girlfriend as the woman running out topless from the desk. that every videotape in the 80s had a tracking issue.
Yeah, right around that time
during that scene for
so
some
strange,
reason.
Yeah.
But yeah, the famous topless woman running out screaming, that was the big role of Joel Silver's girlfriend.
As it turns out.
I wanted this to be professional. Efficient, adult, cooperative, not a lot to ask. Alas, your Mr. Takagi did not see it that way, so he won't be joining us for the rest of his life.
Just a ridiculous, ridiculous cadre of legendary people working on what would be a legendary movie.
Working behind the scenes.
Yes.
That's before we get to in front of the camera. Because
yes.
This movie gave us one of the greatest action heroes of all time. It
Word.
Gave us one of the greatest villains of all time.
Word.
And it also is populated with a who's who of just really cool other icons.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I want to talk about it, and I feel like this is the kind of thing that Die Hard is such an important movie to me that people I know have begun to associate Die Hard with the movie that I will get drunk at a bar and just start off the top of my head riffing about behind the scenes stuff, because the story of how this movie got made and everyone who was offered the role of John McClane, it's lunacy.
It's
absolute
ridiculous.
Fucking lunacy.
Like, let's just hit everybody with...
No, let's do it this way.
Okay.
Who was the very first person offered the role of John McClane?
That's literally what I was going
for. Because this is how I will open every drunken conversation about Die Hard, because it's the most bazonkers thing about Die Hard.
Frank fucking Sinatra.
Frank Sinatra was the first person, and people hear that and they think that I have lost it, or that I had a particularly bad batch of beer, but no. The reason for it, there's a very specific reason that Frank Sinatra was the first one offered, and that is because the book on which this is based is called Nothing Lasts Forever by Roderick Thorpe. And Cargill can attest this because I am looking right at him. I don't need notes for this because I have, like, this is ingrained into my mind by now. So Roderick Thorpe writes a book called Nothing Lasts Forever, which was actually a sequel to a book he had written previously called The Detective, and was to feature the same character. Now, in the 1960s, they made a film version of The Detective starring Frank Sinatra. It was a big deal. And in his contract, it was clearly stated if they ever made a sequel to The Detective, that he would have first right of refusal for the lead role. Therefore, when they adapted Nothing Lasts Forever into Die Hard, they were contractually obligated to offer Frank Sinatra the role of John McClane, to which he promptly told them, "Are you out of your fucking minds? I am way too old for this shit." And they were free. They were free of having to cast Frank Sinatra, but he was technically the first person offered.
Yeah.
That is insane.
Yep. That is how contracts work, my friend. Oh, could you imagine if he said, "Yeah, I want to take the paycheck"?
Hey, yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Die easier. You're going to kill me up here.
Die easier. Oh, man, that's good. And then from there, should we just throw out a few of the names of the people who are offered the role of John McClane? Because we have your Schwarzeneggers and your Stallones, absolutely both offered.
Said no. To Die Hard.
And if I correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure at one point this was being retooled as a Commando sequel so that it could be a vehicle for Schwarzenegger.
Still said no.
And he still said no.
Because keep in mind the movies he was making at this point. None of them were in the same league as Die Hard.
Yeah. I might as well just speed round this. Don Johnson, Harrison Ford, Richard Gere, Clint Eastwood, Burt Reynolds. Burt Reynolds, that's an interesting one. All offered the role of John McClane. All said no. It basically was the situation where they had gone through every leading man in Hollywood until somebody was like, "You know what I really like is the show Moonlighting. And that guy on Moonlighting is actually, he's pretty good. Why don't we give this role to him?" And just, can you imagine being the head of Fox and somebody tells you that nobody wants to be in your tentpole action movie of the summer? You got the director of Die Hard. You got Joel Silver, who is one of your Golden Boy producers, and they're putting this action movie together that no action star wants to be in. So we're going to cast the guy from Moonlighting, who had never done an action movie.
But who was big shit at the time.
Big shit at the time, but
like he blew up. Like, it's
literally in this movie.
It's one of those cultural things that's kind of evaporated now, and people don't remember how big a deal Moonlighting was. But everyone was talking about Moonlighting. Moonlighting fucking was one of those transformational shows on television that everyone just got obsessed for two seasons. Like, it is very much like what happened a few years later with Twin Peaks, where everybody was watching it.
Yeah.
Like, you could not get away from it. And kids who weren't allowed to stay up lied about it and pretended they had watched it because it was such a big deal. And so Bruce Willis was this big happening star, and was he going to hit or was he not going to hit? And he fucking hit.
And he hit, but that gamble, Bruce Willis asked for $5 million, which was unheard of at the time.
Because he was huge.
But untested in this genre, and you've got you got so much writing on this movie. And not only that, but your villain is played by a guy who's never been in an American movie before.
No, nobody knew who the fuck this guy was.
I'm Alan Ruckman reading for the role of Hans Gruber. You're in. You got it. We don't even need to hear you say anymore. That was amazing. And oh my God, like the fact that Alan Rickman as Hans Gruber has become the archetype by which so many action villains have been created.
Well, the thing is he had a perfect run of three movies in a row where he played the villain that he just stole every fucking movie. You cannot talk about these movies without talking about Alan Rickman's performance in it. You just can't, because he's the best part of all these movies. You've got him here in Die Hard. He follows it up with Take a Drink, Junkies, because this one's been on the docket for years. Quigley Down Under. In which he steals a movie from fucking Magnum PI himself, and then follows that up with Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, where he plays the best Sheriff of Nottingham of all time. And like, I can, there's one line every single one of you just thought of that involves a spoon.
It's the minute I said twit, that. It will hurt more. No, I don't know what you're talking about.
He's so amazing. He's so good in these movies.
Yeah.
And we're going to raise a glass to him right now because, dear Christ, we just fucking lost him.
Oh, it sucks. Way too young.
Yeah, yeah. It's it's not that it's way too young because I think he was 69.
Still way too young, I think.
Yeah, I mean, we lost him too early, but the thing is, we got him late. Like, he was like Sam Jackson. Like, he showed up, you know, as an adult before he got his first big gig. And it's like, oh, like, we don't have stuff to go back and watch you earlier in your career. This is where you started. And he was always amazing. So, but yeah, he kicks the shit out of this movie.
It's absolutely incredible. And then we also have, a side character in this movie who was so good, he got his own comedy series, which ran for like 10 years on network television. That is Al Powell, played by Reginald Vell Johnson, who parlayed that into the show Family Matters, where he is also playing a cop. It's like this, the fucking legacy of this movie stretches way beyond the sequels of this movie or all of the action movies that tried to rip this off and just be, I mean, this movie became a standard. Die Hard on A became the go-to elevator pitch for anyone who wanted to sell a movie in Hollywood. It's Die Hard on a boat. It's Die Hard on a train. It's Die Hard on a plane. It's Die Hard in a box with a fox with a bunch of socks. Like,
there's so many of them that Brian insisted on doing a whole episode just on the knockoffs.
We did. The Die Hardlies. It was literally just, and there's really bizarre ones, like Command Performance, where it's Dolph Lundgren as a rock and roll drummer who gets embroiled in a Die Hard situation. There's the one, I always forget, I always want to call it Best in Show, but that's not what it's called, but it's the one at a beauty pageant where Andrew Dice Clay is the bad guy. Like, it gets so fucking weird and bizarre. But I mean, we've covered one. We covered Sudden Death, which is Jean-Claude Van Damme's Die Hard at a hockey game. Like, it became the shadow of this movie and how successful it was and how everyone went apeshit for it changed the entire landscape of the genre, and to the point that they are still making movies that are essentially just Die Hard again.
Sure.
Like, and I'm not even talking, like, the movies that ripped off Die Hard became more like Die Hard than the Die Hard sequels post Die Hard with a Vengeance. Like, the sequels after Die Hard with a Vengeance don't resemble Die Hard anymore.
No, they don't.
But the ripoffs still resemble Die Hard. The ripoffs they're still making today more resemble Die Hard than the Die Hard sequels of today. And that is bizarre to me.
Next time you have a chance to kill someone, don't hesitate.
Thanks for the advice.
Continuing to run down just the cast of baddies in this movie.
Oh, there are two legendary baddies in this movie.
For sure.
Who don't even have more than one or two lines of dialogue each. One of them has none.
Yes, absolutely.
But of course, Al Leung.
Al Leung is, you know who Al Leung is. You don't think you do? You do.
He's one of those guys that through the 80s and 90s was so iconic. He was, if you had a troop of baddies, invariably one of them was Al Leung. He was the Asian guy with the long beard, and the thing is, he was a stuntman, and he was that perfect kind of combination of stuntman and on-screen presence that he would actually get screen time. He wasn't just somebody that would do the stunt taking someone's place. He was the guy you cast in the movie to walk around so that he could die magnificently in a stunt later, and then started just getting roles as baddies even if he wasn't doing stunts, because everybody fucking loved him.
I will tell you the two movies that you will immediately know him from if you don't know him already. He's Genghis Khan in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Yep.
And he's Indo in Lethal Weapon, the guy who keeps electrocuting Mel Gibson until Mel Gibson breaks his neck with his legs.
But you know him from Die Hard as the guy who eats not one, not two, but three different candy bars over the course of the same scene.
He is a man after our own heart.
He goes in and he grabs a Hershey bar. Then we cut back to him and he's eating a Crunch bar. We cut back to him and he's eating a Mars bar. And
so is that a continuity problem or does he just have that much of a sweet tooth?
I when I was younger, I was like, oh, that's continuity. Those are different. I was like, no, motherfucker's sitting there waiting and he's chowing down a cake. And I'm recording a podcast called Junk Food Cinema. I'm going to count how many candy bars he eats, and that's three. He has three different candy bars in that scene.
So really, they're stealing $640,003.17 altogether.
No, because this was 1987, or shot in 1987, and in 1987, you can get a candy bar for 25 cents.
Oh, okay.
Maybe 35 cents, actually.
Oh, fair enough. Fair enough. I guess I was adding inflation to the $640 million.
35-cent candy bars. Old Man Cargill, that old man Cargill.
You might be older than that guy's beard, which is saying something, because that is... That's like an uber Fu Manchu. I love what Al Leong's working with. But, I mean, he's been in a lot of other movies we talked about. He was in I Come in Peace.
Yeah.
He was in Running Scared. This is just a legendary fucking actor. Legendary is also a word that I would use to describe the next person in the crew of thieves, not terrorists. They are not terrorists. I think it's funny that even though people know this movie very well, they still refer to Gruber's gang as terrorists, and they are absolutely not terrorists.
They're not terrorists.
They even make a joke about it in the movie. Who said we were terrorists? But the other member of this crew that I want to kind of call out is William Van Homburg. Wilhelm Van Homburg. Which is the most German, like, it is to Germany what Benedict Cumberbatch is to Britain. The most German name of all time.
And I'm sure it's probably pronounced Wilhelm.
Wilhelm. Yeah, Wilhelm.
Wilhelm von Homburg.
Who all of you
like,
know.
It sounds like that's the name I would make up for a German character who's way too German.
Like, you have an NPC
but
in
he's
your...
not even that German yet. He gets more German. Tell us how he gets more German.
Well, first of all, Wilhelm von Homburg does sound like if you were creating a German NPC in your campaign, your D&D campaign. This is an actor you all know as Viggo the Carpathian from Ghostbusters 2. So an actor who is most well known for roles with almost absolutely zero lines, but he just cuts such an imposing figure on screen. But there's also a reason you didn't see him in much else after that.
He's in another movie that we mentioned that we've already covered.
Oh, which one is that?
Oh, he plays the farmer in The Mouth of Madness. He's
You're
the one whose
right.
son gets
yes.
Taken in by the writer into the church. And he's the one who fires the double-barreled shotgun that has three bullets in it.
Right.
Which is my favorite continuity error.
Is it a continuity error, or is he just eating candy bars? We don't know for sure.
We don't know for sure. But so, yes, Viggo the Carpathian is here with one throwaway line.
I highly, highly recommend you track down the story. I can't remember what website posted it, but if you just search Wilhelm von Homburg, you'll find it. This guy's life, his biography, is one of the craziest fucking stories.
He started as a German professional wrestler. And as his career started to flag there, this is where it gets kind of weird. He then becomes a professional boxer.
Yes.
It's usually the other way around. You start out as a real fighter, you get knocked around too much, then you go into sports entertainment. No, he started in sports entertainment and then got into boxing for like 10 years and had his face beaten to shit. He started out as this beautiful man, and by the end, he was Viggo the Carpathian.
Oh, I'm pretty sure that's what happened to me, too. Oh, wow. It's like, no, that's not quite the same story because... He like the more you hear about this, like his father worked at a Nazi death camp. The two of them were a wrestling tag team for a while. He has like all of these really heinous stories about his family life. And like it is just it's a nightmare story that I feel like is very it's just fascinating. I highly recommend you track this down. Like this is not necessarily a man to be celebrated, but his life story is fucking fascinating. So highly recommend tracking down the life and times of Wilhelm von Homburg.
And is killed by John McClane in an explosion.
And is killed by John. But which, by the way, again, that's what I love about this movie is he has to throw together that solution so quickly that I remember the scene that always makes me laugh is he's putting the detonators in the C4 and you audibly hear him put in two and then think about adding a third and then go, oh, fuck it, and put in like two more. And then when almost the entire building explodes, the look on his face is, oh, that was wrong. I should not have done that at all. And that's what I love about John McClane, is like, he's just doing the best he can. He doesn't know what the fuck to do. This is not his forte. Even though it's, you know, taking out bad guys and he is a cop, like, you get the impression immediately that this is way above his fucking pay grade.
This channel is reserved for emergency calls only.
No fucking shit, lady. Do I sound like I'm ordering a pizza?
There's so much we can talk about with Die Hard that it's hard to even know how to approach this tower, because we also have Robert Davi and Grand L. Bush, two amazing character actors who play the two Johnson FBI agents.
No relation,
of course. But Grand L. Bush, you would also see in movies like Demolition Man. Robert Davi has been in movies we've talked about, like Maniac Cop 2. He is.
Yeah.
I don't recommend you follow him on Twitter, because he is a cuckoo bananas person in real life.
Oh yeah. He's a deplorable. I like the first weekend of the deplorables, he had this epic rant and was like, oh yeah.
Yeah. And then of course, William Atherton, who is famous in movies for just being, we talk about actors being the biggest dick in the room. He is also the biggest dick in the room, but for different reasons. He is the biggest dick and the biggest asshole in any room. I mean, he's Walter Peck from Ghostbusters. He's the guy that releases all the ghosts when he forces the Ghostbusters to shut down the containment unit. This is the kind of role that William Atherton typically played. But you may also know him from Real Genius, from Sugarland Express. Like, this guy just made a career out of kind of being that giant piece of shit. And he's really good at it, so you really can't fault him too much.
And then we have the lieutenant,
the deputy police chief, Dwayne Robertson,
played by Paul Gleason.
Yes, the principal from Breakfast Club is always who he will be to me. Always. Well,
not only always who he'll be to you, that's always who he was. Like, he not only did Breakfast Club, he then replayed that role in virtually everything referencing that movie. He did Not Another Teen Movie. He was in Van Wilder. He actually reprises the role of that principal in an A-Teens music video from the 90s, where they wanted to do a riff on The Breakfast Club.
I am horrified that you know this.
So, oh, it's...
Not surprised. They horrified.
They were the ABBA teens. It was an ABBA cover group put together by ABBA themselves. Like, why would I not know this? this isn't just in my wheelhouse. It's the framework of my wheelhouse.
It's subletting your wheelhouse.
If you need a Paul Gleason fix, he walks in and does the whole shtick, and then they perform. I think that's the one where they do Mamma Mia. Or no, it's Take a Chance on Me. It's their cover of Take a Chance on Me, is from a Breakfast Club riff. And then he comes back in at the end, and, you know, it's the whole Breakfast Club bit. He played that bit so many times, but always seemed to enjoy the shit out of it. He loved playing smarmy fucking characters. And apparently, when he passed away too many years ago, everybody lamented it. It was just one of those things where everyone loved him. Like, everybody was like, oh my God, Paul was the best guy. Like, everybody loved working
with
him.
Well, and you find that out so much about actors who played villains a lot.
It's
I mean, Alan Rickman, everybody fucking loved Alan Rickman.
Well, there's a big truism to it. And what it is people who are playing villains are unselfish actors. They are people who don't need to be the coolest guy on screen. They are people who love acting and love being there and love contributing to the story and are playing that villain so that hero can be greater. People who play the protagonists in stuff, the reason why those people end up sometimes being assholes is those are people who need to be the coolest people in the room. Those are needy people. Those are narcissists sometimes. And I say sometimes because that's not always true. But when you talk about people who are willing to play villains, willing to play bad guys, those are people who love being there, who love doing the job. And those are the people you always want to be around. When Alan Rickman passed, I was shooting Doctor Strange. And of course, you know, I'm shooting in London. Almost every member of the crew had made at least one movie with him, and everyone was talking about him on that day. And everyone was talking, and it wasn't, oh my God, Alan Rickman died. It was, oh my God, Alan died. And it was very much everybody had a story, and everybody was down, and it was a rough day. And so he was, everybody, oh my God, everybody loved him. So it's, he was, God, he was so good.
Yeah.
Now I'm depressed again.
Yeah. Okay. Well, to bring it back to the land of happiness, we've
Die
been.
Hard.
Die hard.
Die hard.
We've talked about Event Horizon. We talked about In the Mouth of Madness, which is interesting because do you know who turned down the role of Hans Gruber? Sam Neill. Sam Neill apparently had the role and was offered the role and turned it down.
Uh-huh.
Which is interesting because Sam Neill has played some decent villains as well.
He is. Sam Neill's a guy who honestly strikes me as a dude who just doesn't give a shit. Like, he loves acting. He loves people, but he does not need to be famous. He does not need to be, the hero. He just kind of does what he wants to do. Like, right now, what's Sam Neill doing? Running a pig farm in New Zealand. Like, because of course he is. And he's tweeting about it because it's fun and introducing everyone to his pigs. Like, he's like, who doesn't fucking love Sam Neill? So Sam Neill passing on this, I could see him being like, yeah, that's not really my thing. I don't want to do this. Or I don't want to work with somebody who's on this movie. Maybe one of the things.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was never somebody that was like hungry, like I must be a star. It was always, hey, this will be cool. I'll enjoy this. And that's how he's always struck me.
And in terms of, you know, we talked about a lot of this movie feeling, or we talked about the character of John McClane feeling like he's kind of careening from one problem to the next. I mean, he really is like the little boy putting his finger in the dike, just like trying to do whatever he can to deal with the situation as it comes up. The production of this movie has a couple things that when you think about Die Hard, when you think about the structure of Die Hard, what makes it so legendary, that were complete fucking accidents or were not intended at all. The first of which being all of these characters we talked about, you know, that Paul Gleason plays, that Reginald Vell Johnson plays, like all of these great little moments that all of the characters outside of John McClane get in the movie that really kind of break up the pace in a really interesting way. We're all just given bigger parts because Bruce Willis was exhausted from having to do Moonlighting and Die Hard at the same time.
Well, it's that, and there's another reason. McTiernan turned this script down several times, and the reason he turned it down is he called it a nasty piece of work. It was the original draft of this was a mean, dark action movie, and he wanted to punch it up. He wanted to make it more fun.
Yeah.
And he wanted to... He wanted to make it a fun popcorn movie. And so all of those characters are really goofy as a result. And it leads to something I was talking about to you earlier off mic. The one shot in this movie that I do not understand. There is a shot in this film that like, why is this here? And you kind of can figure out why, but even then it's like, but that's stupid. Why, when the SWAT team is approaching the building, does one of the SWAT guys get caught up on a thorn on a rose? Like, he gets pricked by thorns on a rose, and he's like, ah.
I have an explanation for that, because Poison was going to be on the soundtrack, and as we all know, every rose has its thorn, and that, no, I'm just making that up. I don't actually know why that happens, and I agree with you 100%.
No, it's they're trying to, the thing is they're trying to make the cops look inept. The cops already look inept. We don't need a cop getting caught on a thorn on a rose bush that he could have walked around. Like, why did you do that?
Yeah.
Like, and why is that shot still there? It's one of those, it's like, I don't, why are you there? Like, there's so much, like, and it's one of those shots you always forget about. Like, it happens and it goes because there's so much cool shit happening, and there's such a density of awesomeness per minute in this movie. Like, there's never a moment in this movie that you're like, oh, I can go out and grab a beer, or I can go get a snack from the fridge. Like, this is a...
It's relentlessly paced.
Even if you've seen it 30 fucking times, if you're going to leave the room, you're going to pause it. Mm-hmm. Because, I'm going to miss that part. There's the density of awesomeness in this movie is unreal. And so to have that shot in such an important sequence, it's just like, what the fuck, dude?
No, I can't argue with that. That does, however, bring us to a point that I think you, as much as we both love this movie, there's one point I think that you and I very much differ on. And the point of contention revolves around Theo. I hate that character. The tech guy who...
The quarterback is
the
toast.
His performance is so goobery, not Hans goobery, but just goobery, that I actually am embarrassed for the movie when he does lines like that. When he's like, the quarterback is toast. I'm like, okay, I get that.
Theo is awesome.
I don't like Theo.
Theo is so much. Theo,
I want more Argyle, less Theo. Hashtag more Argyle.
Well, yeah, first of all, yes, the movie kind of needs a little more Argyle. let's be honest here. It's pretty fucking great. But the thing about Theo is very important to this movie, because with Theo's lines, Ali Young's candy bar moment, and Hans Gruber's, I read about them in Time magazine. Those are the only moments that humanize these guys and make them more than just a forgettable bunch of people that John McClane needs to kill.
Right.
And Theo is the guy who's kind of having a good time. He's a fast talker. He's charismatic. He jokes around. He and Hans clearly have a relationship because he feels comfortable joking around with him, and Hans feels comfortable taking his shit. That is very important to the essence of this movie, because it really shows us what this is and why these guys are together. That is kind of essential. It's something that's missing from so many other movies where you have groups of goons doing stuff. You need some personal moment that the audience sees them as human. Mm-hmm. And it's especially essential here, because how is John McClane, one guy, able to kill 14 dudes? Well, the answer is, these aren't superhuman villains. They're just normal human beings. They're pulling essentially a bank job, and accounted for everything except this. And this guy is actually kind of good at killing people.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes he does it accidentally. You know, there are several people who John McClane kills by accident.
Yeah.
He doesn't mean to kill the brother, you know, in the first fight. They just kind of fall downstairs together. He snaps his neck.
Can we? Okay. Real quick. We have all of these.
Real talk.
Sidebar.
All the other
thieves,
drinks and sidebars,
are either wearing, like, Alan Rickman is in a suit, John Phillips London, you know, rumor has it Arafat buys his there. You know, the other guys are wearing like real tactical stuff, but they still look pretty decent. Carl's brother is wearing a gray sweatsuit that I can only imagine he bought from Walmart on the way to this job. What the fuck? Why? It is so weird to me that he's literally just wearing what looks like pajamas in this fucking movie.
He's the nerdy tech guy.
But he's also like,
he's the phone guy.
He's a brick shithouse too, though. Like, it's just, it is so bizarre to me that he's wearing a matching gray sweatsuit, and he's got tiny feet, because McClane has that line like, you know, 6 million terrorists in the world, I got to kill the one with feet smaller than my sister. Again, we could quote this movie all day, because we know the lines are part of our cinematic language as people. It is how we talk to each other. The script cannot be that you cannot undersell the greatness of this screenplay, because to this day, you could half quote a line from Die Hard in any room, and 4 to 6 people will turn around and finish the line for you.
Come out to the coast, we'll get together, have a few laughs.
It's shibboleth. Like, everyone fucking knows it, and it's amazing to me. But that always weirded me out, that Carl's brother is wearing the cheapest fucking sweatsuit I have ever seen. And again, I know it's not the point, but it still freaks me out a little bit. Also, I do like that Theo comes into the building talking about, like, this is one of the, like, nerdy sports fans things. I mean, he comes in talking about watching a Lakers game, and he's talking about Magic and Kareem and Worthy, and he's like, oh my fucking God, he's talking about James Worthy, and he's talking about Magic Johnson and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and just to think that for a time those guys were all in the same team together, oh, that just makes my little sports geek heart happy.
Two points!
Boom! 2 points. He's so proud of himself too with that line.
Dude, I don't understand your hatred of Theo.
I don't like Theo.
He's so much fun. It's such an interesting, different take on that, and was at the time and still to this day. He's having a good time. Like, he fucking hates the cops, and he loves watching the cops get butt fucked
on national TV, Dwayne.
Like, he's having a good time watching these guys fuck around. And he's also being punny and clever. Like, I don't know anybody in this room who would have a good time making little jokes about that while relaying information. You know, I don't know anyone, Theo. Uh-huh. Yeah. It looks like the police have themselves an RV.
And I mean, I guess there is that to it. And it is fun to switch from doing Heist Month to immediately talking about a movie where the people committing the heist are not the heroes. Because, I mean, in all of the subsequent movies after this, when they went to that they're not terrorists, they're just here to steal something, they did get meaner. It's like when you watch Under Siege is a lot meaner than Die Hard. Even Sudden Death is fucking brutal next to Die Hard. Like, this really is a bunch of guys who are just there to steal shit. I mean, ultimately, they don't care if the hostages die because that actually might help their escape. So, yes, these are not like happy-go-lucky Ocean's, you know, 11 type crew. But at the same time, it doesn't have the same mean-spiritedness as a lot of the movies that would mimic Die Hard later.
And the thing is at its core, this movie's very mean.
Yeah.
Like, this movie brutally kills hostages. You know who we haven't talked about yet?
Ellis. the Joel Silver analog in this movie, Ellis allegedly.
You know, the funny little side note.
All right, mixing drinks again.
We have a good friend who is a young filmmaker.
Sorry, Chris.
I wasn't going to say his name, Chris Todd. But we were at a party at Brian's one night, and I just referred to him as Ellis, and he goes, "What?" And everybody laughed, and they go, "Shit. He does look like Ellis.
He looks exactly like Ellis from Die Hard."
He had no idea he looked like Ellis from Die Hard. And he had grown his hair out and he just looked like Ellis from Die Hard. And he was like, "Fuck you guys, fuck you." And so what he did to show us up was change his profile pic on Facebook to Ellis.
I'll be honest, did not notice.
Nobody noticed. Nobody fucking noticed. And he came to me, he goes, "Dude, I did that." And I was like, "Yeah, I saw it." He goes, "Nobody fucking noticed."
We all just thought it was him.
It was.
It didn't help that I made him start calling everybody Booby.
Booby.
I don't think
Hans.
Booby. Booby. If I remember correctly, there's a story about how a lot of his lines were improvised, and Alan Rickman literally had no idea what he was talking about. So a lot of that reaction from him is genuine.
Speckensy
like,
talk.
What is going on now? Yeah, he is everything to me. You know, there's this running sort of dialogue about how this movie represents a lot of what was going on in American industry in the late 80s and how they were afraid of the takeover of the Japanese industrial complex and how a lot of American executives were really just, you know, coked up, you know, whatever, you know, id pleasing psycho boys. And I feel like if there is a feather in the cap of that theory, it's the fact that Ellis is literally doing cocaine off of Bonnie Bedelia's desk at the beginning of this movie. And John McClane, a police officer, has to say to him, "You missed some." That is one of the great little exchanges that I think kind of falls by the wayside that most people don't recognize. But Takagi says to him, "This is Holly's husband, her policeman husband." And then he shakes Ellis's hand and just goes, points to his nose and goes, "You missed some." Like, it's so good. And I do love that this movie may or may not be addressing that. But the other thing that I think is interesting about this, where the script began versus what ended up on the screen and what people love about this movie, it was originally supposed to take place over 3 days. And so much of what makes Die Hard great is that it's one bad night in John McClane's life. And in fact, all of the sequels are kind of the same idea. All of the sequels are like, this is one instance, one event over one day. And apparently McTiernan's influence for shifting it from a 3-day story to happening in one night was a Midsummer Night's Dream. So, you know, Shakespeare involved in the honing of what would become Die Hard. That's insane. Like, I love that. I love that it's as much Frank Sinatra as it is Shakespeare. Like, so crazy to me that's all of these ingredients coming together for the perfect action movie. And I want to stress that. This is the perfect action movie. Like, everything that happens in this film, the way they establish the hero, the hell that they put him through, the grisly death of all of these terrorists.
It is 2 hours and 12 minutes that feels like a brisk 85.
Yeah, you will never, like, it is, when you sit down and look at the runtime of Die Hard, you think it's a mistake.
Yeah, It's like, no. I can run that whole movie in my head. That movie's 85 minutes. No, yeah, it's 212, but it's 2 hours and 12 minutes. But it is, man, does it fucking fly?
It moves. It moves faster than that RV that the police have, for sure. Yeah, I love this movie. I think that when you talk about all of the various things, when you talk about the dialogue, you talk about the heroes, you talk about the structure, you talk about this fucking cast, the cinematographer, the, like, we could just go on, and for an hour we could have just listed, without going any further, everyone involved with this movie.
It, I mean, and it's important to note what it did, because it, this is what I talked about at the top of the show, it changed the language of action films. When audiences were sitting, this is one of the things that a lot of folks don't understand about how the arts work, is Hollywood is just trying to give you what you want. Like, that's literally what they do. I mean, the way I like to tell some people is, if there was money in bestiality, Hollywood would give you prettier and prettier animals. Like, that's literally how Hollywood works. Like, they don't care. They will give you whatever you will pay for. And when you stop paying for stuff, they just start throwing shit at the wall to see what you will pay for, because there is no metric. There is no way. A lot of people think that Hollywood is shoveling out stuff because they're out of ideas. And it's like, no, they have more ideas than you can imagine. They just don't know how to sell them to you. And Die Hard came at a moment when people were like, you know what? People don't want aliens and laser guns anymore. Like, that's what they wanted for 10 years after Star Wars. And now they're sick of it. What do they want now? And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, they want an everyman. They want a dude in a bad situation who comes out on top. And we saw so many iterations on that after that. You know, sometimes it was a prepared guy like Under Siege. Sometimes it was a teenager like in Toy Soldiers. But this was, we realized we needed something gritty and raw and grounded. And that's what Hollywood gave us for a while. And that sustained us until the indie boom in 94. But this is where Hollywood really turned the corner. And we started getting some very gritty, kind of raw, fun action stuff. And this was the primer. As much as Lethal Weapon in 87 was this big, you know, hit and was doing the cop comedy, buddy comedy thing, that was at the end of towards the end of the buddy comedy stuff. Like, there had already been a bunch of buddy comedies, and this was one of the last great ones. This was the one that gave us a brand new model and really showed us that, oh, we want heroes that aren't indestructible, that bullets don't bounce off of. That's what this new generation wants. And it was the swing into our obsession with realism, which would last 15 years.
Yeah.
We would go into the early aughts being obsessed with realism, and finally the death of realism would come to pass with what became known as torture porn, where even our horror was so gritty and raw, and then all these guys came back from war and said, I don't want to fucking see that. I saw that every day. I want spook houses, and I want superheroes. And then we went into where we are now. And the reason I mention this is because I'm very much, we're starting to feel that we're in the 87, 88 right now, where there's still going to be, you know, big, huge, big budget stuff that's really doing well, like Avengers Infinity War and Black Panther. But there's, when you look at all the other stuff, all of this other big budget stuff is not performing as well. Like, Pacific Rim did not do gangbusters, and Ready Player One did not do gangbusters. And people are going, well, what the hell do you want? We're waiting for that Die Hard. We're waiting for that movie that everybody goes, that is the thing. And then Hollywood will shift again. But this movie fundamentally changed the way America thought about action films. And I think that needs to be said, because we're coming up on the 30th, you know, this is the 30th anniversary of it. And it's time for another genre breaker like that.
And I think it's really important to talk about how dangerous this production was. And I don't just mean, there's a danger in the ad-libbing of a lot of lines. There's a danger in the execution of some of the stunts. Like the scene where John McClane is crawling through the drop shaft and he falls and has to grab on. That was an accident that his stunt double almost fell, and they just left it in the movie. There's a shot where John McClane is running from gunfire and jumps and lands on the ground. And if you look very closely, it's Bruce Willis. It's not a stunt double. If you look very closely, he hits the ground hard and there is a protruding bolt about an inch and a half away from his skull that probably would have like impaled him in the head if he had fallen a little, like, and that's in the movie. The fact that Alan Rickman's reaction when Hans Gruber falls is real because they mistimed the rig falling down.
By like, the way, greatest death of a villain ever.
So amazing. Like so you, amazing.
We're talking about that. You know exactly the look on his face. Like that expression of surprise is one of the greatest moments in action movies history.
And adds a great deal of credence to the theory that this is a condemnation of corporate culture when the thing that finally makes the villain fall to his death is giving up a Rolex watch.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, that is very much a theme of this fucking movie. This movie is very much a rejection of that. It's not only does this movie deal with the theme of the fear of Japanese invasion, it also deals with the fracturing of the family unit as a result of this job. Like, Holly was doing exactly what Holly thought she should be doing, which is following her career, but her career broke up her family. And also, there is that condemnation of John here, where he is, you know, he believes he's the breadwinner, and as a cop, he can't leave his job. He was just kind of waiting for her to come crawling back to him, and he really is fucks up the family as well. But corporate culture really does it. And like that whole thing with Holly Gennaro, mm-hmm. where she's like, well, this is a Japanese company and you've got to understand. Like even there, it is a condemnation of these things. Let's do a little bit of history here because there's a very interesting thing that comes that was happening around this time. We'll play the music again.
Yep.
Old Man Cargill, that old man Cargill.
I need to buy a banjo, I think.
So World War II, we won. We could.
Hey guys, spoiler alert.
Spoiler
we won.
Alert.
I know if you were just sitting down to watch your copy of Saving Private Ryan, I don't want to ruin it for you, but spoiler alert, America won World War II.
Yeah, it was a Deus
Ex
Machina thing. We decided to skip the whole end of the war and just drop two bombs.
How pompous am I that I just said America won World War II as if we did it on our own with no help?
That's because you're an American and that's what we say.
That's what I read in my history books in school. You know.
But that's what we say. So the aftermath of World War II was that we refused to let Japan or Germany, for that matter, have their own standing army. And so as Japan rebuilt itself and we helped them rebuild, they were able to pump a lot more of their GDP, their taxes, into their industry and rebuilding their industry and supporting their industry and giving them tax breaks and giving them, you know, various funds to run from. And in doing that, they created a thing called the Zaibatsu, and the Zaibatsu scared the shit out of us. Now, today, I'm going to explain to you what a Zaibatsu is, and you're going to be like, dude, that's how America runs now.
I think I took a class at my gym on this, right? It's like power cycling?
No.
Okay.
No, a Zaibatsu is a corporation that owns all the fundamental parts of what it needs. So the biggest Zaibatsus at the time were car companies. So the way the old car companies used to run is you'd have a car company that would assemble a car. Well, you'd buy, you know, your motor from this company, and you'd buy your tires from Bridgestone or Firestone, and you'd buy, you know, all your seats and your leather from this company. And so you could have a small business or a larger business that just provided, hey, I make car seats for Fords. That's what we do. Well, a Zaibatsu said it would be much cheaper if nobody else was profiting along the way and we just owned all of these pieces ourselves and could get all of these pieces at cost. And that made it very hard for American car companies to compete. And it's why Japanese cars were so much cheaper. Well, as all these corporations were blowing up in the late 70s and early 80s, they didn't know what to do with all that extra money. So they started investing in the United States and started buying up real estate. And there was such a fear prevalent in society that Japan was going to get their kind of revenge for World War II by economically destroying America and taking over ownership of America.
And let's point out that just perfectly segued, there's a line that Takagi has in this movie that's played as a joke.
Yes.
Pearl Harbor didn't work out, so we got you with tape decks.
That's exactly what that line is about. And this, the reason I'm telling you this is there is an offshoot of science fiction called cyberpunk that was built entirely around this concept. Most of you, when you think of cyberpunk, you think of cyborgs, you think of implants, you think of near future. The core of cyberpunk was always the fear of Japanese takeover of American culture. It was all about Japanese invasion. If you go back and reread that stuff, all the villains are Japanese corporations. It's why in Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049, there's all of this Asian iconography in the world. I read a couple of essays in which people are talking about how this is, they're stealing the aesthetic of Asian culture for this future. And it's like, oh, dude, you need to read up on cyberpunk. Because no, it's not stealing the iconography because it looks cool.
It's a reaction to a very real fear.
It is a very real fear of Asian invasion and swallowing of United States American culture. And so that's such an interesting reaction to it. And we got cyberpunk out of it. And that is also very much at the heart of what Die Hard is about. Die Hard is in the last throes of it because there was still that fear, but at this point the fear was waning. America was becoming more like Japan. We were creating our own zaibatsus. We just didn't call them that. We had our own corporate culture. We had the Reagan era had gone and was very much about deregulation and allowing companies to just become too big to fail.
Yeah.
Like that was very much what Reagan politics were about. And so in order to understand what that was, a lot of people talk about it being about greed and being about a bunch of rich guys trying to get richer. And there's a lot of that there. But a big part of that was a defense against Germany and Japan, whose economies were growing because they didn't need to fund their own defense. And as a result, we needed to protect ourselves from that by allowing our companies to grow as big as these companies to compete on a global level.
Yeah.
And so that's where that whole thought process came from. And so this movie is very much a reaction in the late stages to it. Of course, what would end up happening is in the mid-90s, I want to say 96, the bubble burst on the Japanese economy. They went through a terrible recession, which they never fully recovered from. They're still a global economic power, but the hopes of them growing beyond their current size is now, you know, it was seen as fantasy. Like it was just projections that didn't last. And so Japan has stayed in its own lane and is no longer considered a threat. And we think it's ludicrous now that Japan would have ever economically destroyed us.
It is not random. It is not happenstance that Hans Gruber's crew is a food court of different ethnicities. Because if you look at the national groups that comprise his team, you have Germans, you have Italians, and then, of course, the looming fear of Japanese take. Like, there's a lot of World War II kind of reaction going on in this movie. And not only that, but a lot of the German characters in this movie are played by Russian actors.
Yeah.
Like, this, and then you have Al Young representing China. So
and
it's,
you got Theo, who's American.
You got Theo, who's American, but you have a team made up of countries that the U.S. has either been in direct global conflict with, has been in a Cold War with, or is terrified of in a in sort of an industrial sense. So I don't think that it's accidental that Gruber is running an international team. I think it's all part of this under... It's so... Again, this is what happens when you watch Die Hard a lot. Like, you start uncovering all of these crazy, like, secondary, like, subplots going on, and all of these themes that are at play. And meanwhile, you're in awe of the fact that, you know, they actually fucking blew things up. They had real explosions going on around Nakatomi, which, by the way, was the headquarters of 20th Century Fox. That building that they used as Nakatomi was 20th Century Fox headquarters, and they're lighting off real explosions around what is essentially their boss's house. Like, that is fucking crazy to me. Like, the scene where John McClane drops the C4 and they have every flashbulb on set in the lobby just going off at once to simulate the explosion, and then they're like inserting like really great miniature work. Like, on every level of artisanship, this movie is phenomenal.
Yeah.
and I am blown away by it. One person who was definitely not blown away by this movie, sadly, was Roger Ebert.
See, you always go back to Ebert.
Well, I feel, well, yeah, obviously, I'm going to go with the guy who is probably the most well-known critic of our time, and the guy who it really has become the barometer for, you know, what the critical reaction as a whole was to a movie.
It's very weird. Like, sometimes he was very much in the junk food vein and very appreciative of films that were meant for entertainment. And then in times like this, wow, was he way off the mark.
Well, he got so hung up on specifically Paul Gleason's character that his entire review, his 2-star review, by the way, for Die Hard, was on a technical level, there's a lot to be said for Die Hard. It's when we get some of the unnecessary adornments of the script that the movie shoots itself in the foot. And he specifically calls out police chief, played by Paul Gleason. He says, as near as I can tell, the deputy chief is in the movie for only one purpose, to be consistently wrong at every step of the way and to provide a phony counterpoint to Willis's progress. And he harped on this so much that he literally gave the movie 2 stars. Like, he could not get past it.
He's not wrong. That is exactly why he's there. But except where he's wrong is that he's not there to prove a counterpoint to Willis's progress. McClane's progress. He's there to prove a counterpoint to Al. Like, the whole point of this movie is that, you know, in terms of the cop stuff, is that the politicians and the top brass don't know what the fuck they're doing. It's the cops on the street that matter. It's the everyman. That's the reason Al and John have such a connection, is they're both street cops. They're both guys who've been in the shit. They're both guys who've seen shit. They're the guys who fucking know. They're there to do a fucking job.
Yeah.
That is all it is. I am doing this because it's right. I am putting my life on the line because it's right. Not because I'm the biggest dick in the room and not because it will help my career. I'm doing it because it's right. And Paul Gleason is the representation of everything that's wrong with political police officers.
His review ends with this scathing line. Here's a suggestion for thriller makers. You can't go wrong if all the characters in your movie are at least as intelligent as most of the characters in your audience. Like, Jesus, Ebert. Like, really just taking Paul Gleason to task in this movie. It's kind of incredible. And by the way, the relationship between Al Powell and John McClane, I still, real talk, get a little misty when they meet, but like when they first meet and you see John McClane just kind of mouth the word Al, like, you're Al, and he just kind of nods and accepts or acknowledges that, yeah, it's like that's such a great moment, which is followed up by a somewhat problematic moment where we heard this story about how Al Powell accidentally shot a kid and it was something that he lived with all this regret. And then as soon as Carl gets up, he's found the heroic moment where he's found the strength to murder people again, which just followed by when Argyle comes out of the garage in the limo, Powell's ready to shoot him too. And McClane has to be like, no, maybe we don't kill this one. I'm glad you got your power of murder back, but maybe just put the gun away. Like, it's a little problematic that his big heroic end note is you have found the strength once again to pull the trigger.
Well, I mean, I don't think that's problematic. I don't think that's problematic at all.
It is when you watch the movie now. It's kind of problematic. I will go on record.
I watched the movie last night. It did not seem problematic. It's not that he found the power of murder. It's to draw his gun again because he was afraid to actually act anymore because he challenged his own choices.
Yeah.
And this entire movie is about him following his instinct and trusting his instincts again, because he's hearing things and seeing things that he's not being told that other people aren't picking up on. Like, he's the one that says, I think he's a cop. Why? It's the way he talks. A couple of the things he said, he's following his instincts again and he trusts his instincts again. And that's really Al Powell's issue. It's not that he can't draw a gun anymore. It's that he doesn't trust his own instincts because he made it the wrong call once. And it was a horrible call and he feels bad about it. But I feel like he's earned that personally. I do think the joke about wanting to shoot Argyle at that point is then
it's like, okay, let's.
It's a joke too far, but at that point, the movie is just going bam, 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 that you're just kind of like, that moment comes and goes. And
yeah, I'm just saying, it would be, if they remade Die Hard, it would be the part they left out because of the news.
I'm curious if they would do that in this day and age.
Yeah.
Because the whole idea, I think a screenwriter might spend more time on that storyline, like the whole concept of a cop who means well but shot someone and shot a kid, you know, is something that we're dealing with in the headlines today. And we have a we have an atmosphere where any cop who is shot an innocent person is instantly the bad guy. We don't, we generally in the public eye, give them the benefit of the doubt. Not that we always should, because there have been so many bad shoots, and we, how many videos have we seen of cops shooting someone and then going over and drop, like we've actually seen video of a cop dropping a gun by an innocent person. So of course we have these trust issues. So to have that character there and to explore that, and that guy who really is torn up about it, trying to become a hero again, I think is something we might see.
Well, I think the problem is that so many of the cases that we're hearing about are not well-intentioned police officers.
Right. No, I know, because that, you know, you want clicks in this culture, give us a bad guy. We love a bad
guy.
Well,
but I mean, I don't think you can deny the fact that it's happening in uncomfortable numbers, that you have shootings of innocent people. Like, honestly, if they really wanted to explore this, and I can't believe this is the first time I've ever said this about a remake, I feel like you need to make that character white, because so much of what's going on in our current zeitgeist with this specific issue is about racism more than it's about procedure, more than it's about trusting instincts. And I feel like if you wanted to explore, of course, it changes how you perceive that character. And I don't know that you would be like, oh, sweet Al Powell, I'm so glad that they finally got to meet, and it's a warm moment if you explore that. If you really want to explore that in a remake of Die Hard, I feel like that cop needs to be white, because that's the issue we're having right now, is you have a lot of racism that's backing the decision. It's not about trusting it's about trusting an instinct that is very problematic. It's an instinct born of years and years and years of prejudice more than its actual police instinct. So, yeah.
So since you tugged at that thread, let's do a lightning round. I have two questions for you. The first one is, if we were to remake this today, who is John McClane?
Oof. Not Jai Courtney, I can tell you that much. It's definitely not Jai Courtney. Wow. No, that's a really good question, because you need someone that you can sell both as an action hero, but also, like, and again, I feel like you can use as your litmus test a lot of these sort of diehard like antecedents that have come out. Like, you could talk about people like Gerard Butler, you could talk about people like Channing Tatum, people who have actually recently been in movies designed to be diehard knockoffs. And like, even Jamie Foxx had one with Sleepless, which was a remake of Sleepless Night, which is really a French diehard in a nightclub kind of situation. Man, that's a really good question. So who plays John McClane in a diehard remake? I don't know. What are your thoughts on this? Do you have
Idris Elba?
That's interesting.
Idris Elba as John McClane, doing it as, you know, the older cop. Idris Elba, I think, is one of the only guys with the level of pathos. I mean, 15 years ago, it'd be Denzel Washington.
Oh, 1,000%. You know, 1,000% it would be.
But, you know, there's not a lot of guys who I think could really pull off John McClane in this day and age. We just don't have, and I mean, it's something that people have talked about. It's the machismo problem we have with the current generation of actors, that we went after a bunch of actors had boyish charm and boyish quality, and those guys grew up and are still boyish actors, and just don't, as we've talked about, like, you know who I would love? I don't think, because of his career, I don't think it would everybody would be excited for it, but if they saw it, it would be awesome. Carl Urban.
Oh, yeah.
Fucking Carl Urban as John McClane fucking would be awesome. Although he's already done that with Judge Dredd, because Judge Dredd is kind of diehard in the future.
Yeah.
They're locked in the building. They're going up the skyscraper. It's fucking Die Hard.
It's incredible when you start thinking about how many movies owe their existence to Die Hard.
Okay, so now here's the second question.
Good, because I didn't have an answer for that.
I know. That's fine. I was leaving it and pretending, let's skip in the witches.
Yeah.
Of that list that you read earlier, mm-hmm. if you had to choose someone who is offered the role of John McClane from that list,
ooh.
Who would you pick?
Ooh.
Who would you cast?
Ooh.
Knowing that Bruce Willis is your first choice and he has passed on right. Die Hard, who from that list of people that were offered in the alternate reality, you get to say yes?
Jesus Christ. Okay. There is, my heart wants to say Stallone, but no, not Stallone. I feel like there is an interesting connection now based on what we've talked about to it being Harrison Ford.
See, that's actually Harrison Ford is my pick.
Yeah. Like, and I feel like the idea of just the finger of doom in Hans Gruber's face and just like that scene where Hans is doing that fake American accent. And all of a sudden, it's a way different scene when Harrison Ford still wants to shoot him because he's just that grouchy. Like, that's interesting to me. That's a really interesting idea. Like, that is a universe I probably would have been happy in. Plus, in that universe, Harrison Ford is officially now Indiana Jones, Han Solo, Blade Runner, and John McClane.
Yeah.
He owns geekdom at that point. And he is the king of all geeks, more so than he kind of already is. Yeah, no, I kind of like that scenario. I'm 100%.
Is that the alternate universe where he also plays MacReady in The Thing?
Yes. I kind of wish he would play, instead of MacReady in The Thing, if he was Wilford Brimley's character in The Thing, and he's just out in that shack, and he's just like, hey, it wanted to be us. Because that's a movie
they'd
that
a grumble off.
They'd have a grumble. What do you keep talking about fucking oatmeal and fucking, I don't understand.
Diabetes.
No, diabetes.
Do you really think you have a chance against us, Mr. Cowboy?
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing, and I feel like
if
the
this
easy
isn't a
choice,
box of candy bars, I'm going to be very upset.
I feel like the easier choice for this movie is the Twinkie, because there is a really great moment where another... multiple moments, you're right, where Al Powell and McClane bond over their mutual love of Twinkies. However, if we ever do Ghostbusters, I feel like that is a more appropriate junk food pairing for Ghostbusters, unless we do Ecto-Cooler. I don't know. So instead...
there's too much Ghostbusters junk food.
Too much Ghostbusters junk food. Instead, I'm going to go with a TV dinner, because there is a great line of dialogue where John McClane is crawling through the vents and he says, now I know what a TV dinner feels like.
That's literally the one joke in the movie. That's my Theo moment.
And just to piss Cargill off, I've decided that TV dinners are the junk food pairing, because the other great thing about TV dinners is you can get TV dinners from every cultural dish that you want. If you want Chinese food, if you want Italian food, if you want Japanese food, there is a frozen dinner, there is a TV dinner that will accommodate, much like Hans Gruber, that will accommodate everyone. So I feel like there is something even more appropriate to, you know, again, a TV dinner being the junk food pairing of this
movie. So many good junk food pairings here, because I will toss in the variety box that you can get at the grocery store of like five different candy bars.
This is true. Yeah.
Or I would actually also...
Which we will now start calling the Al Leong special.
The Al Leong special. Ooh.
Yeah.
I would also suggest a stacker. Like
Stacker?
You know, a really tall sandwich where you have just different types of meats level to level to a ridiculous height, because you have it that way. We had a place here in town called Elevation Burger where you could actually get the Elevation Burger, and there was a level where you could get like eight hamburgers all stacked together. And I feel like that's the diehard burger. Like, not only is it going to kill you, but it is just a tower of awesomeness.
But it's so big, it actually has to be delivered by Pacific Courier in one of their trucks, which, by the way, guys, if you haven't noticed, the Pacific Courier plays very importantly into Speed, which is, it's the name of the truck that brings all of the criminals to Nakatomi in Die Hard. It's also the name, it's the same company that's on the plane into which the bus crashes and explodes, because Jan de Bont obviously worked on Die Hard. And then in Die Hard with a Vengeance, which is back in New York, at the very beginning when the department store explodes, you see a truck get flipped over that says Atlantic Courier. So it's this weird sort of Die Hardiverse. It's the Joel Silververse too, because as we mentioned during Ricochet, Mary Ellen Trainer plays Gail Wallins, who is a reporter both in Die Hard and in Ricochet. So there is a bigger overall Joel Silververse. Also, there is a country mentioned that the villain from the second Die Hard is from, that is also the country where the terrorists from Commando are from. So there's, I like the idea that we live in a Joel Silververse.
The D'Souza-verse.
The D'Souza-verse. That's right. That's right. The D'Souza-verse. All apologies to Stephen E. D'Souza. It is, in fact, the D'Souza-verse. Guys, thank you so much for joining us on this extra long episode about Die Hard, because of course we were going to fucking talk about Die Hard for an hour and a half. Of course we were. How could we not? We could do another hour and a half. Don't get us started too late because we're done. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
On Twitter and Instagram, at MassaWyrm, MassaWyrm.
Awesome. And you can find me on Twitter at BriarGuySalisbury. You can find Cargill and I at Denver Comic Con, June 15th through the 17th, doing a live show there. And I'll be moderating some panels as well. It's going to be a good time, Denver, so come on out for that. Cargill, you're going to be at Cinema Apocalypse in Chicago?
Yeah, from the 21st to the 28th at the Music Box Theater. And also, you can find me in, my new book comes out June 12th. We're going to have a book release here at Book People on June 11th, if you want to come down for that. I'll also be in Boston, apparently, on June 12th, and then with you, Denver, the next weekend, and then in Chicago the week after that. Boy, is my wife happy that I'm traveling so much in June.
And then you and I in July at Convergence are doing a live Junk Food Cinema. So it's just, if you can't get enough of us, then if you live in a city in America at this point, there's a good chance that one or both of us will be appearing. So congratulations to you. I'm sorry, but I'm gonna wrap this episode the only possible way that I could, by saying yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
The podcast is toast.
Oh, Jesus Christ. We're gonna die.